Hi, Jeff Sachs here with Masechet Ta'anit from Web Yeshiva and Mishkan Tzipora. Some programming notes. Next week we have a wedding. The daughter of our Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Bravender, is getting married, so we will not have Shir on Tuesday night. And then we'll be in touch about going forward as we get closer to Pesach. Last time, hello Sharon, welcome back. Last time we saw the Choni HaMagil stories, and then somehow in that way that Facebook probably knew that we were learning that daf in Ta'anit, this image showed up somewhere in my feed, about a father and a son watering a sapling, and he tells him, one day you'll appreciate the truly important things in life, the father tells his son, and then the son, years later, looking up to his father in heaven, says, thanks, Dad, as he pushes his own son on a swing hanging from the boughs of this new tree. And of course, this is the message of, or one of the messages of the Choni HaMagil story. The story appears on Daf Kaf Bet Omud Aleph in Ta'anit. There are two main components to the story. I'm not going to repeat it again because we did learn it last week. But the first one is the story of the rain. That when they needed rain, they would come to Tachoni, and he would draw a circle and he would stand it and he would tell God, "I'm not moving until you send the rain." And Choni was such that he would bring the rain. He had that power. And the Chachamim were not so certain that this was always the best way to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim by doing this. But somehow, nevertheless, it worked. Rain came, so much rain that they had to ask him not to keep bringing the rain. They had to ask him to stop the rain. And that is how it connected with our story with our Gemara, which had mentioned this idea that you don't daven to stop too much of a good thing. You daven to stop bad things. But too much of a good thing, which is of itself, of course, not a good thing, but since it contains goodness just in excess measure, you don't daven against that. If wild animals are coming and killing babies, any measure of that is no good. So you daven to stop it. You do tshuva to stop it. You fast to stop it. But rain, we talked last week about the bell curve, too little and too much is no good. But rain itself is inherently good. And therefore, you don't daven to stop it. And that was how our story came on. The Gemara then had gone on to the next, perhaps more famous story about Choni, falling asleep for 70 years. He was unsure how it could be that when David HaMelech says in Tehillim, "Hayinu kicha az yamu vagoyim higdil Hashem az hayinu kichomim," right? Shuva Hashem et shivat Zion hayinu kichomim. When God brought back the after the 70 years of galut Bavel, it was like we were dreaming. So he said, how could you be dreaming for 70 years? Which doesn't seem at all to be the pshat of the pasuk, or of the Gemara. It's shown him how somebody could in fact sleep for 70 years. He sees a man planting carob trees. The carob trees are going to take a long time until they flower and give fruit. Choni says, how could you possibly imagine you're going to be around to see those, to reap the benefits of this tree? And the old man says, no, it's not for me, it's for my eineklich. Just like I enjoy a good piece of carob, which, you know, that's the most difficult thing. That you want to, that somebody fell asleep for 70 years Rip Van Winkle style, isn't so hard to believe, but that somebody really loved carob so much, I never found it so tasty. But when he comes out after 7 days. He says, I liked carob. My grandparents planted a carob that I should have it, and I'm planting for my children and my children's children. This question, which agitated David last week, which, you know, was quite predictable. How could he have misread the Pasuk so blatantly? How could Choni have thought that it meant literally we were dreaming and sleeping for 70 years? So this, of course, disturbed Baruch Shekivanta David. This disturbed the Chidushe HaGaonim, which is a commentary in the Ein Yaakov, and the Vilna Gaon himself in his is quoted as being disturbed by this question. The answers that are given are really quite straightforward. Choni did not literally think that they were asleep for 70 years, or that they were dreaming for 70 years. Choni's question wasn't how could somebody have been sleeping for 70 years, but how could someone, meaning how could they have been, you know, chopping the log, as we say around here in the Sachs household. Remember in the cartoons when somebody was asleep? Remember like in the Popeye cartoons, you'd see above his head a log and a saw cutting through it, you know, to remember that? So when Shalom, our 25-year-old, was a little kid, he used to watch cartoons. He once asked, he said, why is somebody always chopping a log when they're asleep? What is that? So somehow that became, in our family, that became the euphemism or the idiom for either sleeping or snoring, right? You know, like he'd be snoring away and we'd say, you were really chopping a log last night. So the irony is that Choni learns the lesson by himself chopping the log for 70 years, by himself falling asleep for 70 years. In other words,
I think the pasuk of David HaMelech, I think the way I understood it always is that the people were in Galut for 70 years, and they got used to the Galut. And then when all of a sudden it wasn't Galut, they said, well, it must be a dream, you know?
That Geula is like a dream.
Yeah.
Meaning like a nightmare.
Well, whatever. It was just right. It changed. They just weren't used to
right.
it.
But in other words, it's not like what we were fed on, you know, in Zionist boot camp. Hayinu kecholmim, the dream was fulfilled, right?
Yeah, okay.
But it's almost like saying, you know, when they told us we were going back, it was almost like a fantasy, meaning it was not completely realistic or believable. But that's not what the Mefarshim here are really inclined to say. They're saying that Choni felt that the people...
By the way, just a note that apparently the it might even the shot of the verse might actually not even be referring to dreamers,
but to...
it might be referring in the, there's a then it's like those that were healed, like machlimim, machalumim. That there's an opinion in the Targum seems to translate that. The Targum translates that way, and Dabi Kra explains it that way. So that actually might be the actual meaning of the verse. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it appears as kechalomim instead of kecholmim.
Well, that's certainly not how the Gemara here, you know, reads.
Clearly.
You know, and
but you're talking about the pshat of the pasuk,
right. But I mean, there's the pshat, and then there's the pshat of the pshat. The pshat of the pasuk is dreamers. That's how the pasuk is simply interpreted by the majority of the tradition and by the uninterrupted engagement with the verse. Even though you want to say that might not be actually what it means. But as Rabbi Bravender often points out, pshat doesn't mean what the pasuk might actually mean. Pshat means the plain way in which Chazal read it.
Right, so Dov Rappel, the professor, lay professor Dov Rappel, he made a difference between pshat and mashma. He said mashma is the literal meaning of the word.
Yeah, okay.
Pshat, right. So if you talk about like, al kanfei nesharim, then the pshat is not talking about literally an eagle's wings or vulture's wings. The pshat is talking about, the pshat is a metaphor.
Right.
But you want to know what nesher means, you're talking about the mashma of the word, not the pshat.
Yes, there's an interesting article coming out in a certain Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought, a long article in our next issue about the Ramban's use of biblical metaphor, or the Ramban's treatment of biblical metaphor, and when exactly that, where the metaphor doesn't mean Right? In other words, a metaphor means that the pshat is the mash, is the nimshal, not the mashal. So Choni wants to know, like, what could possibly, in the world of Galut, you know, we know about Galut. I mean, maybe some people listening to the archives are in Galut right now, but we, at least those of us that have logged in now, we're all here in Eretz Yisrael, so we can be spiritually superior while talking amongst ourselves. And where are those people in Galut that didn't log in tonight? Well, you know, probably they're distracted with the Havlei Olam, as people in Galut tend to be. You know, for those of you that don't understand exactly how dry my sense of humor is, I feel compelled to add an asterisk and let you know that I'm exaggerating for humoristic... I mean, those of you that know me understand by now, but I'm afraid there are people out there listening on the archives that don't get it. But Choni says that, you know, in Galut, you know, that's what it is. People get distracted. They waste their time. They get invested in this worldly things. They spent their 70 years, 70 years being the length of the Galut, but 70 years also being a kind of like biblical, typical lifespan. You know, being spiritually asleep, you know, in a kind of spiritual slumber, like the Rambam. I mean, interestingly, they don't cite this, but, you know, the Rambam's famous idea that's what tshuva is. Tshuva is to wake you from the spiritual slumber. You know, people who are, you know, kind of sleeping, as it were, again, metaphorically, sleeping through life, letting it pass them by, letting the important things, and that's what bothered her. Choni said, how could it be? People spend a whole lifetime in Galut, mentally asleep, spiritually asleep. So Hashem's answer to him in what happens, you know, is that he shows him this guy planting the tree. And he learns that, you know, it's kind of actually similar to the Agadah of Shimon bar Yochai and his son in the cave. And when they come out and kind of getting a sense of, you know, there are ways to contribute to the world that aren't just, the study of Zohar, you know, aren't only just these kinds of intense monastic spiritual experiences. And when they see that, like, a person walking home carrying flowers for Shabbat, you know, or hadassim for Shabbat, in order to beautify the Shabbat, you know, that's also a way that the mitzvot are beloved on Israel. They figure, you know, maybe we shouldn't burn up everybody that's plowing his field. So there's something parallel there that, you know, Choni realizes that dealing with, you know, Olam Hazeh, like planting a carob tree, is itself a metaphor for planning for the future and investing in future generations. And things of that nature, that in Olam Haba, like, you know, investing in Olam Haba is a long-term investment. But it's a mistake to think that all involvement in Olam Hazeh is a short-term investment. And being confronted with the guy and his tree and his 70 years was a way of kind of communicating that to Choni. So the Gro goes on to say that later when he after he meets the guy and he sits down, you know, under the wall, and he sits down to break bread to eat, you know, which is of course parallel to those earlier Gemaras that we saw. So what does he immediately do? He immediately starts engaging in this worldly physical acts. I mean, obviously he must have been eating other days also, but the fact that the Agadah is constructed in a way to tell us that the very first thing he does is he breaks bread and he sits down and eats. So it means that he came to the realization that the desires of Olam Hazeh, like eating, you know, can either be something which caused distraction or not. So he's kind of covered up by this formation, this rock, whatever it is, whether it's an avalanche or this rock grows up, or you know, like in the Rip Van Winkle story, the banyan tree grows down and covers him up. When he comes out after 70 years, what's the first thing that he sees? He sees all of these donkeys. He had one donkey. And now he sees there's like a whole herd of donkeys. And he comes to realize that these are the, you know, many, many generations later that his donkey turned into a whole herd. And of course, a chamor is, you know, like you call down to central casting for a symbol of something this worldly, something gashmi, something chomri, right? Something physical. So the symbolism of like a whole bunch of donkeys, of, you know, something material, might be part of what sent that, you know, why that symbol is what populates the Agada. So Choni has to kind of come to this lesson. My friend Rabbi Yitzi Blau, you know, who lives over here in Alon Shvut, has a lovely book called Fresh Fruit and Vintage Wine, which are readings of different Agadot Chazal. So this is what he has to say on the Choni story. He asks, how should we evaluate the character of Choni? If results are the criteria, the first story indicates that his methods were successful. Because what happens in the first part of the story? He says, you need rain, I'm going to bring you rain. He draws a circle. He makes a threat to God, right? And he forces God, you know, the way that, you know, he's called in the Gemara, basically he's a spoiled child. He's a spoiled child that gets his way. But we all know about that, right? Because usually, why does the spoiled child often get their way? I mean, we all know as parents, and if not, we probably know as having been children once upon a time, spoiled children often get their way because it's easier to give into them than to have to deal with them. Right? I mean, you all remember this. Some of you, it's been a while. Some of you are already grandparents many times over. So it's okay to spoil. When you're a grandparent, it's your job to make sure that they're spoiled children. As my parents often tell me, you know, there's a common enemy between grandparents and grandchildren. But
that's why they get along so well.
Right. But you know, we often give in to spoiled children because it's just easier in the short term to give in and to avoid the temper tantrum and avoid the meltdown in the supermarket and the, you know, the whatever it is, than to do the hard work of, you know, actually parenting. So Choni is the spoiled child. He says to God, you send rain, I'm not leaving here. Right? And he's almost forcing God's hand. That's what Shimon ben Shetach says to him. You potentially caused a terrible Chilul Shem Shamayim. Because if God didn't send the rain, you would have either had to have broken your neder, or if it had been a situation where it wasn't supposed to rain, and it rained anyway, so you could, in the case of Eliyahu HaNavi, who said there's going to be no rain, so you would have proven Eliyahu, could you imagine your action would have led to Eliyahu HaNavi being taken as a false prophet? Right? So Shimon ben Shetach doubts the appropriateness of Choni's approach from the perspective of possible Chilul Shem Shamayim. Shimon's concerns focused on the possibility that God might not respond to Choni, who would then be forced to violate his oath sworn in God's name. Rashi adds that Choni did not speak respectfully enough to God. Right? The way that Choni kind of like tells God, you better do it. Right? That's not an appropriate way. But because Choni was a ben bayit in God's house, he had a kind of intimate relationship, which, you know, might be, you know, like I gave that example last week of, you know, the depiction of the intimacy of the servant and the master, the maid, the lady's maid and the mistress, of the house, you know, in those kinds of like British upstairs, downstairs dramas, right? So even if behind closed doors, the lady's maid who's been, you know, serving the lady of the house maybe for decades, and they've developed a kind of intimate relationship, and even if behind closed doors there's a certain amount of even though everybody knows their place, there's a certain amount of intimacy or casualness, the lady's maid would never dare speak that way to the mistress of the house in front of anyone else, not in front of the other servants, not in front of the other members of the family, but Choni does. The second story, the story about falling asleep for 70 years, indicates that Choni's method is problematic from another perspective. And then he quotes here a book by Aaron Agus, who was a writer on rabbinic literature, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, I think. Has developed an overarching theory about two personality types in the Talmud. There are those who look for immediate solutions in one great moment of heroism, such as martyrdom or through a miracle. Others endure difficulties and patiently await the unfolding of history as they direct their energies toward guarding a law. Choni demands instantaneous solution from God. He represents the first approach. The obvious flaw in this approach is that solutions are not always immediate, and implementing them sometimes depends upon the ability to persist and endure. So, if that's the case, without looking ahead, you can understand how the two stories relate to each other. In the first case, in the story of bringing the rain, forcing God's hand, he needs an immediate result. But in the case of waiting out the 70 years of exile, which to us seem, you know, after all, 70 years of exile, right? We would have taken that in a second if that was what was on offer. A lot better than 2,000 plus. But from this perspective, the second story provides a critique of Choni in the first. Choni cannot understand why the psalmist lauds the return from Babylon because he feels that 70 years of exile is much too long to wait for redemption. So maybe Rabbi Blau is saying, I'm saying this, but I'm saying it because I think this is what the insight that I gained from Yitzi's reading of the Agadah. What didn't Choni understand about the idea of Hayinu Kecholmim? Right? We were like dreamers. It wasn't how could anybody sleep for 70 years. It wasn't a physiological question. How could you be in a coma for 70 years? It was a question, how can you keep dreaming for 70 years, right? If you will it, it is no dream, right? Says Herzl, right? But for how long? How long can you keep it up? How long can you keep dreaming of Zion and not give up? And since Choni was a man of instant results, he didn't believe that the Golei Bavel would be able to keep the faith for 70 years. That was the question that he was asking. Similarly, he fails to appreciate the planting of the carob tree when the payoff is so distant. Nonetheless, we need to eat carobs. So ancestors must plant with their grandchildren in mind. Moreover, we need to find solace, and can do so even in the possibility of a slow return from the exile. Choni's lack of understanding of the latter tale reflects poorly on his approach in the former, because he can't believe that people are going to keep the faith for 70 years of Galut, let alone the 2,000 years that are more familiar to us. So it implies the critique of Shimon ben Shetach that the story, the second story, comes as a kind of corrective to teach him the lesson of what he doesn't understand in the first story, even though in the first story he's a hero.
Isn't there a difference between, I mean, obviously, between like the immediate need for water, which they just couldn't wait, and the carob tree, which you have to plant in advance? I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily a... Maybe is it necessarily a critique of the first story, or is it just like two different circumstances? The water, they needed an immediate solution. And the character, you can't have an immediate solution because you can't, as much as you want it now, you have to wait.
Right, but except the carob tree is a metaphor for galut. In other words, so what category? So you're right. Obviously, if you want carobs, you got to plant, and you have to wait. And you'll never eat the fruit of the carob tree you planted, but you'll be grateful to those that came before. But what about galut? What kind is galut? A carob tree, or is it a dire drought? Is it something we need an immediate response to, or is it something that we have to work now in order to plant the seeds for 70 years from now?
I mean, you could use the example, I don't know, if you want to like talk about, I don't know, what's going on like in Ukraine. So like, you know, we've been trying for many years to get Jews to move, to make Aliyah from Ukraine, and it takes a lot of investment, a lot of time and efforts and resources, and trying to know it's not going to be immediate. And then occasionally there's a need for an immediate solution where you have to just, you know, airlift people out of there because of the immediate danger. I mean, it really depends on the circumstance, I think, no?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you can certainly read it the other way. You can certainly read it as saying there are two types of situations. There's sometimes you need an immediate response. Sometimes you have to force God's hand, and other times you have to be patient and wait and lay the groundwork. And adrabba, trying to rush something that requires a long investment is always going to lead to a bad result. But that's not how all of these mefarshim from the Gra until our contemporary friend and neighbor, have read it. Now he brings an insight from Yonah Frankel. Yonah Frankel was a professor of Talmud and principally of Agadah at Hebrew U. He wrote a number of important works in Hebrew on interpreting Agadot. Yonah Frankel's reading is similar to that of Agos, except that Frankel emphasizes an egocentric element in Choni's personality. He bases this on the fact that Choni does not feel adequately honored upon his return to the study hall. Remember, when he comes back, his family, his kids don't recognize, his grandchildren don't recognize him, his family doesn't recognize him. He goes to the Beis Medrash, and what does he hear in the Beis Medrash? Like that story about Moshe Rabbeinu and Rabbi Akiva. They're saying, oh, in the good old days of Choni, they're still quoting Choni. But they're quoting Choni, they're not exactly quoting his Torah. What are they doing? They're quoting his ability to solve the problems, right? Choni's a problem solver. Whenever there'd be a kasha in the Beis Medrash, Choni would make it clear as day, right? Which is kind of funny because his great talent was not in bringing, light, but in bringing rain clouds. It's an interesting, right, you know, kind of... thing. You think of Choni, you think his logo is like an umbrella, you know, not sunshine. And but when he gets to the Beis Medrash, he says, "I'm Choni," and they don't believe him, right? And they make fun of him because they think he's just a crazy old man. And then he asks for mercy, and you know, at the end of this long life, God takes him, right? And because he's not, Frankel says, since Choni doesn't feel adequately honored upon his return to the Beis Medrash, I am inclined to reject. I'm inclined to reject Frankel's reading, because Rabbi Yochanan refers to Choni as a tzaddik. Furthermore, lack of patience and selfishness are distinct character flaws. Right? You can have a lack of patience, right? But that doesn't mean you're not righteous. It doesn't mean that you're inherently selfish. An altruistic person can alleviate the pain of others even without understanding the need for long-term solutions. Choni genuinely wants to help the people in the first story. His problems stem from his need for immediate resolutions. And knowing the two things, knowing when you need an immediate result, you know, like somebody has a heart attack in the street, right? You don't like say, well, let's make sure his next meal is healthy, because we want to lower his cholesterol, right? No, you call Mata, you give him CPR, you start mouth to mouth, right?
Maybe the whole, now that you're saying this, I think in a sense, the whole story of Choni, the first story, is like, it stands in opposition to the entire, message of Masechet Ta'anit.
How?
Right? What's the message of Misachat Tanei? You don't get rain. What are you supposed to do?
You're supposed to
do tshuva. It takes time, and you have to do something. There's a reason. We're like, if we don't get rain, that's time we have to fast, and we have to do tshuva. We have to change our ways and everything. Right. We can't like suddenly. So, it's not like.
So then it's not.
Another jukebox and expect it to start working. And then, say, no, if you make a demand, it'll.
But then it's not a critique on Choni. Who is it a critique on?
I guess whoever included the story in the
Messiah. No. It's a critique on the people that turn to Choni as the wonder worker. In other words, there's no rain. It's a desperate situation. Yatsa Rov Adar. They're already at this time of year and there hasn't been any rain yet. Right? And so they go running to Choni. Choni's their ace in the hole. No. That's the mistake. Right, if your reading is correct, then it's a very convincing insight, David. So then the critique isn't on Choni, right? The world has wonder. We all know that the world has wonder workers, and some of them are tzaddikim and they're miracle workers, and some of them are charlatans and carnival barkers and right. But it's a critique on the people that put their faith in those people instead of saying, oh, yatsa rov adar. We better do tshuva. We better start fasting. We better start davening. But instead, it's the people that turn for the miracle max, right? In the hope that it's a shortcut. Wouldn't we all want that? Like, you know, it's going to come Rosh Chodesh Elul soon enough. You know, if you do it right, it's a long 40 days. I was listening on the radio today. They were talking to people about getting ready for, you know, it's coming up the starting Ramadan, the Arabs. Which, I mean, you can understand why they're always so cranky. You know, if Jews had to fast for 30 days in a row, I don't want to think what we'd be like. So, they were talking about, like, you know, 30 days of Ramadan. It's a, you know, the people that really do it. It's a big haul. It's a big spiritual investment. It's difficult. It's physically difficult. It's tiring. But we have 40 days of from El Rosh Chodesh Elul to Yom Kippur, and even we're, I think, all Ashkenazim. You know, we don't even start with the Slichot. You know, from Rosh Chodesh, but still, it's like work. It's like Emo and Yira, and you have to make an investment of time. But what if somebody told you, no, you don't have to do that. We're gonna have a Chazan. On Yom Kippur, he's going to be so great, you won't even need to daven. All you have to be, you'll just be there, and he'll lift you up. Right? So we would probably want to, you know, a lot of people would probably fall for that. Because it's always easier to turn to the miracle worker than to do the actual hard work yourself. So then maybe that's the hidden critique here on what's happening, that there's no shortcuts. I mean, it could be that, like, the rain came, but that in the long run, there are no shortcuts. Anyway, then Rabbi Blau goes on to make a point about the current age and the internet and, you know, other types of media and things in our culture, which, you know, ever more so push us towards, you know, the kind of instant fix and the lack of patience and the lack of ability to the long plan, but I'll leave that to you to figure out the mussar of all of those things. The Gemara goes on at the bottom of Kaf Bet Omud Aleph and then onto Kaf Gimel with a story, you know, not a dissimilar story. It's obvious why this is connected. The story of Abba Chilkiah, who was a grandson of Choni, who also was involved in the family business of rainmaking. It's a rather long piece of Agadah, and I apologize, but I have to leave a drop early to get my son back to school tonight. So before we start that long Agadah, I'm not going to start and get interrupted in the middle, so we'll cut it short. And I remind you, next week I have a wedding, so I can't teach on Tuesday night. Okay. But then we'll have there'll be one more shiur before Pesach, I think. Now, tomorrow night, as part of the Web Yeshiva series, tomorrow night at 9, I think, I'm giving a special shiur about the Haggadah. If you'd like to join us here on Web Yeshiva, I'll send out a link to those of you that are on the WhatsApp group. I'll send out the link directly, but you can also go to the Web Yeshiva Facebook or the Web Yeshiva website to sign up for that. My shiur and all the other shiurim, we're doing a lot of pre-Pesach shiurim on Web Yeshiva now. You know, going through the simanim. You know, like somebody did on Kadesh and Urchatz and Karpas. So tomorrow night I'm up to Magid. But come for the whoever's doing Shulchan Aruch, because they'll maybe give out food.
Which of Rabbi Ravinder's grandchildren is getting married?
No, his daughter. His last, he has a daughter who was never married, who's of the age where you can get married. His daughter Shevi Batsheva, and it's a great simcha that his Rabbi Ravinder has grandchildren who are married. Many grandchildren who are married, but he's got one daughter who's now getting married. Baruch Hashem. On Tuesday night, so it's a big simcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Thank you. Before you go off,
yeah.
I have to apologize for being late and in and out.
Oh, okay.
In light of the same thing that you were referring to, my son Akiva just got engaged.
Mazel tov.
Mazel tov.
Kiddush. When's the chasana?
Not sure yet when, but. Bezrat Hashem, I think it's probably going to be in the summer.
Who's the caller?
Her name is Liba Spivak.
Oh.
He's from a bunch of places. Her family's in Vancouver. She originally grew up in Skver. And
she's a Jewish girl.
Absolutely.
Okay. Like from Skver or a Skver?
The family originally was from Square.
Okay, well.
And 1 minute, what? And then from there and to Telstone, Arnof, all around.
Right. Listen, Svi, if you don't have to, but if you invite me to the wedding, I want to order the special kosher meal. I'll sit on the side. You can double wrap it.
Which one?
I'll give you a list.
Well, when we do it, we've got, we have to take care of it, handle vegan, we have to handle gluten-free, we have to handle...